Good evening, everyone. And welcome to our live broadcast in Second Life. And locally, the real reason for doing this every night is that I have meditators here, people who are dedicating their whole waking hours to the practice of insight meditation. Doesn't that just sound like something you all would like to do? If you haven't done it, I'm going to introduce you tonight to someone who has just graduated means he just finished our foundation course. But he's actually someone who's been practicing insight meditation for quite a while. I first met him in Winnipeg several years ago, 2013-ish, 12, I can't remember. 11, maybe. We've been keeping in touch and practicing similar styles, and finally he's come over to try out our technique, so I'd like to get his take and see how this course what part it's played in his practice. This is Ali.
Hello everyone. My voice comes across well.
Yeah. I think so.
So my name is Ali. As Banta mentioned, I met him about 4 years ago in Winnipeg. And now that I reflect back, in those days, Banta always talked about the meditation center. And now that I came here and meditated for 3 weeks, I'm so happy that to see that actually realized, and what a beautiful space and community has been created here. It's amazing. It's so lovely to see practitioners, supporters from different countries, Thailand, Sri Lanka, other countries from Canada, who really are very generous and support this center. And to have Banta here really to just present the authentic Buddhist teachings is so valuable. To have all this support for us to practice. And the atmosphere is so conducive. The teachings are so on point and direct. And if someone really is fortunate enough to, can take, 20, 30 days of their lives and dedicate practice, and practice here under, with this, well-planned, well-thought methods, then the results are certain, I would say. And so yes, that's what I just came across now. And
I always put people on the spot. And I know you've just come out of the course, so it's hard to really get everything sort of settled in your mind. But how do you feel coming into the course? You've been a meditator before, so it can't have had a life changing. It hasn't turned your life from night to day. But how do you feel this course has played a part in your practice?
I feel very healthy now. I wasn't 3 weeks ago, and my practice has had become a little bit weaker than it used to be like 3-4 years ago. Mm. In the past, I would say 3 months, something, 3-4, 6 months. And as a result, I was more stressed and here I really wanted to come here to kind of, I think what in my mind I thought, you know, I had realizations and I just need to deepen them, but here it was a truly humbling experience. I learned a lot about the suffering and kind of the mistakes that I, you know, I have been making in my life, and places I wasn't mindful, and kind of then really I think experienced what in with much more clarity what I think I just had some glimpse about before, but really like this this course just helped me to really to a point of no return, as I would say. It's just things are so clear that I don't think they could ever forget and not see them again. So yeah, and I feel very healthy now, and that's essentially what I would summarize. Like I feel I was sick and now I'm well.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Great. Great words. Thank you. So congratulations to Ali for making it through meditation course. I remember once listening in on reporting before I started teaching. We in Thailand, they get a lot of Israeli meditators. A lot of Israelis go to Thailand because they have to serve in the war, and or not in the war, they have to serve in the army, and after the army they all run away to Thailand. It's apparently a thing. India as well, but they leave the country. So anyway, you get a lot of Israeli meditators, and one of them, he, as he was finishing the course on like the second to last day, he said, "You should teach this to the Israeli army. This is harder than anything I had to do in my military training." And if you know anything about the Israeli military, it's that is saying something, from what I hear. It's not easy. The great thing about the meditation practice is it's pushing, it pushes you beyond, it pushes you far, so far out of your comfort zone. But it does it gently. It's like, it's a soft brick. It's getting hit in the head with a brick wrapped in a pillow or something like that. But it's very, we push the meditators very hard. But we do it slowly, and it's the power of mindfulness is so strong that you don't really even falter. Most people don't even falter. I don't think I've had a single person who got beyond the basic, you know, the first few days, or the first, got over the first sort of adjustment pains. Since I've been back in Canada, I don't think I've had a single person run away. I mean, it says something to their dedication that they're willing to come all the way to Canada to do this, but you know, it's been really super high graduation rate. Very few people I think there's been a few people who leave after a few days because it was much more difficult than they thought, and they just weren't ready for it, prepared for it. But by and large, it's the kind of difficulty that you're happy to do, that you're glad to challenge yourself with. I think that's why people leave in the beginning, is because they weren't expecting a challenge. So that's the one thing I try to get across to people, especially when they're thinking of coming to do a course, is that it's not easy. It's not meant to be pleasant all the time or calming. And some people are looking for that. And I mean, most people, I think, to some extent, are expecting that. They're expecting peace, even subconsciously. And so a big part of the basic, or the beginning stages of the course, are helping someone come to terms with the fact that reality isn't butterflies and rainbows or whatever. That reality is uncomfortable. And so helping meditators to come outside of their comfort zone and to challenge everything that they hold, as real, as dear, as me, as mine, and so on. But it's a whole other level. Those people who have never done, if you've never done an intensive course, as Ali was saying, it's great to hear the idea that you get this idea that through your practice you're gaining insight. That's true, you certainly are, but you tend to overestimate, if you just do daily practice, you tend to overestimate your progress. You know, you fit meditation into your life without actually challenging your identity, your personality, your likes and dislikes, without really challenging samsara. Meditation challenges the meditation course. It's designed to challenge all of samsara, the whole of your existence, the very framework of what it means to experience. And so you're taken to places. I mean, at the end, it can get kind of surreal, where your experiences are your mind can sometimes be playing tricks on you, and it feels like reality is just a moments of experience. You lose track of the world around you and you see only reality. And you're able to break it apart and let go and attain to true peace. And so, we can never say we can't really talk about what meditators get out of the practice. It wouldn't be fair, because we ourselves are not, we're not a Buddha that we're not equipped to pronounce people as having gained this or that attainment on any level. But it's encouraging just to hear these things. And this is a tradition. My teacher would always make a point of having meditators talk about just the feeling that they get, how they feel, how different they feel, as a means of encouraging others and making clear that this is a positive experience. It's not something to be afraid of. I mean, that's the great thing about how the meditation challenges you. You start to realize that it's not the meditation that's hard. It's that we're not we're not programmed for it. It's our own mind and our own defilements that makes the meditation hard. And so you take refuge in the meditation over your own personality. You come to be your own enemy, and the meditation is a better friend than you are to yourself. And so by using this growing seed of mindfulness, you start to root out all the stuff inside that's causing you harm. I mean, that's really it, is we are our worst enemies. There's no worse enemy than the untrained mind. This is the paradigm shift that has to take place, rather than in the beginning, a meditator will see the meditation as a problem. The meditation is the enemy. It's what's causing me suffering. And when they make that break, they start to realize, wait a minute, I'm the one. It's my problem. It's not the meditation. And it reverses. You start to use the Buddha's teaching to overcome yourself. So this is the best thing that I could encourage on anyone, is to take the time. I mean, it's why teaching has always been a part of my life as a Buddhist monk, not because I'm terribly keen to teach, but because of how powerful it is. What a great thing it is to go through the course. You know, how transformative it is. Not just of an individual, but of society, of the world, to have people in it that have cultivated such depth of understanding to the very core of experience, the core of reality. And it's not some theoretical or it's not an equation, something you can put down on paper, but it's a purity, the mind that is free from greed, anger, and delusion. It's the ability to see the nature of your own mind. And so through the foundation course, you of course don't become, I don't know that anyone I've ever seen has become an arahant from doing a single course. Not that I would be able to tell. But the first thing it does, it's called Pachavekananyana. At the very end of the course, when a meditator is starting to settle back down after going through the whole program, they take stock, the mind begins to assess what has changed. And so the meditator who has gone through the course is at this unique position where they can see their own minds, where they're clear about their position on the path. So they see where they've come, what they've accomplished, what they've attained. And maybe not, you know, exactly. It's not completely clear what they are or what they've attained, but they see the difference. And then they also see the road ahead. They see quite clearly what they have left to do, because they've spent the past 2-3 weeks living with their own mind, studying their own mind. And so they're quite clear what needs yet to be done. Quite clear what bad habits they still have, what confusion might still be in the mind, what delusion there still is to root out. So, as I said before, someone said it's like seeing that what you've been studying is only the tip of the iceberg, but you've come to understand that. You know, that's really a big part of the finish of the course is. Throughout the course, you're working on the iceberg that you can see above water. When you get to the end, you see underwater, and you see what's left to be done. So I thought that would be a sort of a special edition of our talk tonight, our session tonight, to give you all a little bit of encouragement from someone who's been practicing for a while and is able to give an honest review of the process for those of you who are here doing the course with us, or those of you who are thinking to, those of you who want a better understanding, for all of us to get a sort of a better understanding and clarity about what doing an intensive meditation course entails. So thank you, Ali. And I'm going to give that up for tonight's Dhamma. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to take them. Otherwise, have a good night. I saw in a video that insinuation is a branch of lying. Is this true? No, it's on a different level, because actually outright lying is like you've committed to it. You know, it's like the difference between hurting someone and killing them. You kill you've committed. I mean, it's a bit more extreme, but there's still room to back out when you're just insinuating something. It's clearly immoral. You know, there's the different. If you're trying to trick someone, that's not a good thing. If you're trying, you know, though you could argue you're trying to trick them for wholesome purposes. I think you could potentially argue that. You could argue that. There are cases where arahants have actually tried to trick people, but they don't lie, because lying is on another level. Lying is the commission of deception. It's a level of deception that is. It's a perversion, right? Because truth and wisdom are so important, and to say as true something that is false, or say as false something that is true, there's a weight to it. Karma is never black and white. It all comes down. The only thing black and white is our state of mind when we do things. So a person can tell a lie with the best intentions and it won't be that negative. The consequences won't be that negative karmically. A person can tell a very small lie with very bad intentions and it can have very weighty karmic consequences. And if they feel guilty about it afterwards, it will be even worse. Because guilt, of course, is also unwholesome. But no, we don't consider deception, simple deception, as lying or insinuation. It's much more, I mean, it helps to draw a clear distinction, if nothing else, that, you know, if you're going to be deceptive, we're all deceptive in various ways, we're not perfect, and so through our defilements we'll manipulate each other and deceive others, but we take as a vow that we won't go to the extent of actually outright lying. That's the idea, is that it's crossing a line. And you can argue it's just a line in the sand, it's not real, it's just a concept, but there is something to it, and it helps sort of set a marker for us. At the very minimum, we won't do that, even though we might deceive each other from time to time. We won't outright lie. I mean, if you think about it, because lies are so terrible. When you tell a lie and someone believes it, it's, you know, it's not just that they insinuated something, it's that they said, and you believe them, right? And we're so, we don't have telepathy that we can understand, so we believe each other, and we have to. We rely upon words, statements. Insinuation is not that. When you actually outright lie, it's such a terrible thing. The Buddha even said, if a person lies, there's no evil they won't commit. I think he said in the Jataka or somewhere, or else it was the Bodhisatta, I can't remember. Lying is the worst. If a person lies, there's no evil that they won't commit. So it's definitely considered to be a bad one. Well, there's the famous case, and it's just in the Dhammapada commentary, so it could always be suspicious, dubious authenticity, where Sariputta tells this executioner, says, you know, he can't concentrate on Sariputta's teaching because he's feeling guilty about all the killing that he's done, executing people. And so Sariputta asks him, you know, well, did you do it on your own behest, or did you do it because someone else told you to? And he said, well, I did it because someone else told me to. And Sariputta says, well, then how can you say it's your fault, or is it really your fault? I think he asks him, well, then are you really to blame? With the insinuation or the implying that he wasn't to blame. But of course he was. You know, you don't get out of killing just because someone else tells you to. It's still a very terrible thing that he did, but it's a deception. Sariputta actually, in a sense, deceived. Now, you might argue that an arahant wouldn't do that. I would argue that an arahant would not be afraid. I mean, it's all about your intentions, for the most part. Until you cross those lines, there's something decisive about actually saying something that's false. It's on a different level from implying, even tricking people. When you outright lie to them, it's evil. Okay, well, let's call it a night then. Wishing you all good practice, happy trails.